The winner of this year's State Poetry Out Loud competition didn't make a lot of noise. Dakota, or DJ Meyer, is a student at the Iowa School for the Deaf. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk with DJ Meyer about his poetry performance and his hopes for the national competition in Washington, D.C., going on right now. I'll also talk with Patrick Clancy. He is superintendent of the Iowa School for the Deaf and the Iowa Braille and Sight Saving School. We'll talk about education in Iowa for deaf and blind students and how that education has changed in recent years. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Every year, students from all over the state of Iowa compete in the Poetry Out Loud competition. To compete, students memorize and then perform three poems in front of an audience and judges. The state finals are held in March, and one student from Iowa competes each year in the national competition held in Washington, D.C. All of the students who compete select their poems and work on their performance. This year's state winner had an extra step. After he selected his poems, Dakota Meyer, who goes by DJ, had to translate them into American Sign Language. DJ is a junior at the Iowa School for the Deaf in Council Bluffs. He's in Washington, D.C. right now for the national competition, but I spoke to him before his trip. An American Sign Language translator signed my questions to DJ, and you will hear his answers. Hello, DJ.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. Thank you so much for being here today. I wonder, what made you want to compete in a poetry competition?
Well, because I like poetry myself, and I thought that if I started doing this poetry competition, I would probably understand poetry more better and practice. And
do you write your own poetry?
Oh, no. I got it from different poets, and the one I really like is Edwin Arlington Robinson. I have two of his poems that I'm going to use for the Poetry Out Loud competition.
And from him, you selected Miniver Chivi and Richard Corey. Why did you select those two poems for your competition?
I actually had that in one of my classes when I was learning about American literature. And I'm not sure which one I saw first, but it caught my eye, and I really liked that poem because it applied to me in my life. For example, like Miniver Chivi, it was talking about how we can have deeper connections with other people in life, deeper connections than Facebook, deeper connections than texting. I want people to have a better connection with each other, talking in person, have a personal bond instead of talking on Facebook and all that. Because this guy in Miniver Chivi wished he lived in a long time ago, where people were each other, and that was it. There was no technology.
What did you like about the poem Richard Corey?
Richard Corey talks about a guy that takes things for granted and didn't appreciate the small things in life, and he had money, education, he had that charm, and just one summer night he decided to go home and put a bullet through his head because he didn't appreciate the small things in life. And life's, it's a trick question. Life's most precious gift is life itself, and he seemed to not appreciate it and decided to take his life when you should have counted your blessings and appreciate small things in life and learn how to apply it with other people.
The other poem that you chose was A Psalm of Life by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Why that poem?
I chose this one because at first I am a Christian, and a psalm of life titled Self Caught My Eye. So I decided to read it, see if it would connect to me in a way. And the way it rhymed and the way it was put, it caught my eye and my heart as well. And it was easier to memorize because of how it goes in my head, and I can imagine signing it because I use ASL instead of speaking. So things in life are scary, and reading this makes me feel like that other people think I have obstacles in life that I have to face, which I do, but with my faith in God, there are no obstacles in life for me, the way I see it from my view.
All of the students who compete in this competition have to select poems and memorize them, just like you did. But you had to do something else. You had to translate your poems into American Sign Language. What's that process like?
Oh, it's very complicated. Because at first, I actually had to keep reading it, and I memorized the English in my head. And then I have to translate it to ASL, which is not, for me, it's not that hard, but it's a challenge. I'll have to keep going over and over and try to figure out which sign I should use for this, what sign I use for that, and try to make it fit, through the whole poem.
You mentioned that you really liked the rhyming of the Longfellow poem that you chose. If you're performing the poem in American Sign Language, this is a physical performance. Is there something special about a rhyme that you can convey with your body?
Well, for ASL, technically, no. There's no rhyming and signing. It's just I'll have to find different ways how to use my hands and my body, like describe a tree with my finger, describe a tree with my hand, describe a tree like as me and my body, act like a tree, you know what I mean? Stuff like that. It's not rhyming in ASL. It's completely different. That's what makes it a little bit harder.
How do you convey the emotion of a poem when you're signing?
Well, deaf culture, you have to use your facial expressions all the time. So when I sign, it just comes to me, my expressions and my body movement smoothly, that's all.
Part of winning this competition is that you get to go to Washington, D.C. to compete in the national competition. Have you ever been to Washington, D.C. before?
Oh, I've never touched Washington, D.C. This is my first time. I actually wanted to see a college down there named Gallaudet University.
Right. Gallaudet University is a university for deaf students. You get to choose a chaperone to go with you on this trip. Who's going with you?
Oh, Kevin Boyce. He happens to be my cheer coach, my dance coach, and he used to be my basketball assistant coach. And he's my staff at the dorm. He's a house parent. And he's also a friend to me. He's a very wonderful guy. He knows poetry. He can sing. He can dance. He's a model. And, wow, he's a very interesting man. Yeah, and he's also deaf, too. He's hard of hearing like me.
Since you've never been to Washington, D.C. before, what are you most excited about seeing when you're there?
Well, for right now, college. I want to look around the campus when I have time because everybody here always talks about going to Gallaudet, and I even wanted to go to Gallaudet. So it would be nice to look around and see what college I might be attending to.
Are you also hoping to see some of the sites in Washington, D.C.?
Yes, of course. There was like a spy museum, the statue about the Vietnam War, Abraham Lincoln statue, yeah, the Washington Monument. I want to see that. And the Holocaust Museum, I really want to see that too.
It sounds like you have a lot to keep you busy for 3 days when you're there. How big an audience will you be performing in front of in Washington, D.C.? Do you know?
I'm not sure. I try not to think about it.
You have an opportunity to teach a lot of people at least a little bit about deaf culture through this performance. What do you want people to know about deaf culture?
I want people to know that deaf people function just like hearing people do. We can communicate, we can sleep, we can eat, we can socialize, we can play sports, we can work, we can do anything anybody else can do except hear. And that's all. And I want them to know that you can also be in poetry too. Just because poetry involves speaking, you can change it into ASL as well. There's no problem with that.
You're a junior right now. I know you're starting to think about college. What do you think you want to do after college?
Well, I have thought of many different positions. I thought of being a doctor, a teacher, many things. But right now I'm thinking about political studies, like becoming a senator maybe. I don't know. I want to try to do what most deaf people can't do.
DJ, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, too.
DJ Meyer, the winner of this year's State Poetry Out Loud competition. He is a junior at the Iowa School for the Deaf in Council Bluffs. I asked DJ, before I let him go, which one of the poems he performed that he would like us to read on the show today, and he picked Richard Cory by Edwin Arlington Robinson, read here by Dennis Reese.
Whenever Richard Cory went downtown, we people on the pavement looked at him. He was a gentleman from sole to crown, clean-favored and imperially slim. And he was always quietly arrayed, and he was always human when he talked. But still he fluttered pulses when he said, "Good morning." And he glittered when he walked. And he was rich. Yes, richer than a king. And admirably schooled in every grace. In fine, we thought he was everything to make us wish that we were in his place. So on we worked, waited for the light, went on without the meat, and cursed the bread. And Richard Cory, one calm summer night, went home and put a bullet through his head.
And this is Simon and Garfunkel's version of Richard Cory. Coming up, I'll talk with Patrick Clancy, superintendent of the Iowa School for the Deaf. We'll talk about education for deaf students and blind students in the state of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa.
Almost everywhere he goes, Richard Cory at the opera, Richard Cory at a show, and the rumor of his parties and the orgies on his yacht. Oh, he surely must be happy with everything he's got.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My conversation with DJ Meyer, the winner of the State Poetry Out Loud competition this year, made me want to know more about deaf education in Iowa. And with me now is Patrick Clancy. He is the superintendent of the Iowa School for the Deaf in Council Bluffs and also the superintendent of the Iowa Braille and Sight Saving School based in Vinton. Hello, Patrick.
Hi, Charity. I'm happy to be with you.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. I do want to talk about education for both of these groups of special students in Iowa, but I want to start with the Iowa School for the Deaf in Council Bluffs. How many students attend that school?
We serve we serve 110 students there on the campus, and of that, 100 of them come from Iowa, and we do serve some Nebraska students, so there are about 10 students from Nebraska.
And the Iowa School for the Deaf still operates as a boarding school?
The Iowa School for the Deaf certainly does. It has a residential component to it, but of those 110 students, about two-thirds of them are there during the week overnight, and about a third of them come in on a day basis from their homes.
And you mentioned that you serve students from Iowa and Nebraska. Why are there Nebraska students who attend this school?
There's a small number of Nebraska students that need the type of services that Iowa School for the Deaf can provide, And Nebraska is one of the states that no longer has a school for the deaf that has a residential component to it. And so we're actually pleased to be able to accommodate that need when the need arises in Nebraska.
The students who attend the school all have some kind of hearing loss, but I understand that there's quite a wide variety of the kind of impairment that these students deal with. Can you give me an overview?
That certainly is true. All the students that are there definitely meet the qualifications for deaf and hard of hearing, but the majority of them would be hard of hearing students, with a smaller percentage of them being deaf. Needing more, the deaf students certainly rely much more heavily on manual communication, ASL, where many of the students that are hard of hearing, basically manual communication and oral communication are often a possibility with them. And we also serve students who have sensory impairments who are deaf, but have additional disabilities, students that are deafblind, a combination of both sensory impairments, as well as students that are deaf with additional significant types of needs.
There have been some dramatic changes in recent years over treatments for deafness, including, of course, cochlear implants. And you have students at the school who have cochlear implants.
We certainly do. We have a number of students there who have cochlear implants, and where the cochlear implants assist them greatly in terms of their understanding of language and their ability to hear sounds and all of that. But even with cochlear implants, it really does not restore hearing to a normal level. And so they still qualify and benefit from communication channels that are both oral as well as manual.
Can you give me an idea of some of the special skills that students who attend the school can acquire that maybe they couldn't get in another way?
Certainly, the biggest of those is around communication, because for students who are deaf and hard of hearing, that's the most significant barrier is full access to full communication with teachers, with adults, with peers. And so a significant reason for direct instruction at Iowa School for the Deaf is to make sure that students do have direct and ready access to full communication in that more direct way, where it doesn't rely on another to interpret what is being said in the classroom or what is being said between peers and all of that.
Can you take me into a classroom if I were to visit a classroom at the Iowa School for the Deaf? I'm assuming that I would see the use of American Sign Language in the classroom, but what else would I experience that wouldn't be something that I would see in a traditional classroom?
Well, first of all, you would see an awful lot of what you would see in a traditional classroom, because we are offering the core curriculum and core curricular offerings there. Certainly, from a structure standpoint, you are right. You would see American Sign Language and students using ASL, as well as the faculty and staff all using ASL for instruction, as well as oral instruction to support those that rely heavily on oral communication for that. You would see some different structures in terms of seating and arrangements of classrooms to make sure that. That's primarily to make sure that everybody has ready access to those people that are signing, and that it isn't just facing the teacher, but it is more of a structure where student to students can observe each other, as well as teacher to students and all of that. You'd see, although you'd see this in a lot of other public school settings as well, but you'd see a considerable use of technology to support instruction, the use of the whiteboards and the computers that are connected to that, because that then is a visual that also supports the information being obtained in a way that's visual when the auditory modality is more limited in terms of access to information that way. You'd see a smaller class ratio, and that's to a large extent because of the low incidence of the population, but also within that classroom, you would see a very great variance in terms of the individual student's needs. And so the smaller class ratio allows the faculty to individualize much more for the differing needs of the students within that classroom.
Do all the students who attend the school learn American Sign Language?
They do. The vast majority of the students, come there with having at least some background in terms of American Sign Language, but not all of them. And those that that do not have American Sign Language before they come there, they learn American Sign Language so that they can communicate directly with their peers as well as their teachers and all that in bilingual and in both languages, American Sign Language as well as English. And it has been found that that individuals who are hard of hearing, who are able to benefit from oral communication, usually receive considerable benefit if both types of communication are used. So, things can be missed from an oral standpoint that would be supported from a manual standpoint.
And when we spoke to DJ a little while ago, we spoke to him through an interpreter, but he could speak to us. Is it important for the students to learn to speak so that, those of us who don't know American Sign Language can understand them?
That certainly is one of the reasons that it's important for them to learn to speak, and certainly from a full integration into society, into our society, to work and all of that. If a student has the abilities to hear and be able to speak, it serves them well, but not all students do, and they rely fully on manual communication, and they can also still be very successful. But if both capabilities are there because of hearing being supported either by cochlear implants or by being hard of hearing, then being bilingual is certainly an advantage for students. And students who can speak and understand language, often they're still, many of them are not speaking and understanding language at the same level as somebody who does not have a hearing impairment.
When students come to the Iowa School for the Deaf, is this something, and I'm sure also there are many different kinds of students that come, do some come for a short period of time, for a year, to learn some special skills and then return to their communities, or are most of them longer-term students?
Well, you were right with your lead-in to the question in terms of you're sure that there's a lot of differences, and that is definitely true. There are students like DJ who has been at Iowa School for the Deaf for most all of his educational career and will be a graduate from Iowa School for the Deaf. And then there certainly are students who do not come until later in their educational career, might not come until high school age, and the demands of the high school curriculum and being able to access information in their home communities with the use of interpreter and all of that becomes a greater challenge at high school, and so come for those types of reasons at that time. There's certainly students that come at a younger age, develop more of the communication skills with our speech and language pathologist and with everybody having abilities around manual communication, and then go back to their home districts and home schools where they also get services and good services, but services in a different kind of way.
And the school actually provides transportation for these students to go home and see their families, don't they?
We do, and believe that that's a really important part of the program. It's, the disadvantage of being a boarding or a residential school or a school that serves the whole state and students need to come in is that it isn't as natural in terms of that contact with families on a regular basis. So we think it's important to return them home almost every Friday and then bring them back in again on Sunday evening so that they have a blend of family time as well as the campus-based experience during the week.
That must be quite the logistical challenge. I mean, Council Bluffs is way out west. How do you do that?
Well, we have different routes. We have a transportation system and somebody that sets up the transportation, and there's like a half a dozen different routes that go out, and so there would be a route that's heading towards the southeast and one that's heading towards the northwest and one that's heading towards the northeast, and obviously along the way there's drop points and pickup points for students. And so it's that's the process. And, you know, that's, I think, the commitment that you have to make with a residential school when you want to make sure that there's a strong family component to it.
Take me inside the dormitory. I mean, when I think about a dormitory, of course, my experience was in college, and it's a loud place, and you hear alarm clocks, and you hear telephones, and you hear people knocking on the door, and people shouting down the hallway. Is the dormitory with a bunch of kids in it, is it a loud place?
Well, you know, there certainly are people that would think that a school for the deaf is a very quiet place to be, and that isn't true. There's a lot of similarities to other environments in terms of noise and sound and speech and all of that. And so, you know, because we are a place that relies heavily and believes strongly in the use of ASL to support communication, we expect students to be signing in those environments, but they can also and should be oral in those environments. And so it's not the quiet kind of place that some people would think of in terms of a school that is serving primarily students that are deaf or significantly hard of hearing in terms of their needs. So there's a lot of sounds that are, you know, our students participate in, and they like music just like all other students of that age, and they're performers and they enjoy that. You know, for those that are more deaf, they would certainly rely more heavily on the vibrations and that part of the experience. But a lot of our students, again, hear enough that they benefit greatly from those kinds of sounds.
What are some of the special technologies that are in place to help with everyday living? Like if somebody's knocking on someone's door, they can't necessarily hear that.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's probably people that could speak to some of the detail of that better than me. That's my editorial going into this. But we certainly are equipped with light systems to make sure that that students are alerted to different kinds of things that sound systems and other kinds of environments would do. You know, I'm thinking as you asked the question of our alarm systems for tornado or for fire, as an example, that they are a significant blinking light kind of system instead of a sound system, and one kind of light conveys one message where another kind of light conveys another message.
I want to move to focusing on the education for blind students in Iowa in just a moment, but also a comparison, because the Iowa Braille and Sight Saving School transitioned into being a day school and a support for students around the state in 2011. Why has the boarding school aspect of the Iowa School for the Deaf endured?
Yeah, there's some major differences there. And certainly one of the major differences is around the need for students to come together and to receive a specific kind of instruction. And where students who are blind, visually impaired do not have the need around communication, students that are deaf and hard of hearing do have that need. And that is significant in terms of their ability to be fully integrated. Lots of students who are deaf and hard of hearing are integrated quite fully throughout the state. But it is a real difference in terms of the need for a school that has a boarding residential kind of component to it. Is really around the communication needs of the students. And, you know, the other thing that I would say that we can get into as we speak about blind and visually impaired is that the population size, the students who are deaf and hard of hearing is about three times greater than those that are blind and visually impaired. So there's 110 students that need that service at Iowa School for the Deaf and need that kind of programming, where the numbers were single digit in terms of the blind and visually impaired who were requiring that kind of residential component to their program at the time of the change in service delivery here a few years ago.
Now, I'm sure that even in a mainstream situation, there are many extracurricular activities that a child who is hard of hearing or is deaf could participate in. But I wonder, with the Iowa School for the Deaf, does that open up a world of possibilities for dance and sports and all kinds of other things, that it would be hard for that those students to participate in at a traditional school?
You're so right about that, that one of the real advantages that, students find who come to Iowa School for the Deaf is that they have readily available to them sports, extracurricular activities, dance, plays, that they can provide fine arts kinds of productions that they can be a part of, that they should have access to on a level within their home school districts, but it's harder for that to happen at the home school district level than it is at Iowa School for the Deaf. And so, you know, I think many our students are very active. They're very active in terms of taking part in all of those extracurricular kinds of activities. And I think most of them would speak to how their experience has really been enriched by having those kinds of opportunities during their school careers, including high school careers, and definitely at a level that is much greater than most of them would have been able to participate in had they not been a part of the Iowa School for the Deaf experience.
Patrick Clancy is the superintendent of both the Iowa School for the Deaf and the Iowa Braille and Sight Saving School. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about education of deaf and blind students in Iowa. And my guest is Patrick Clancy, who is superintendent of both the Iowa School for the Deaf and the Iowa Braille and Sight Saving School. And Patrick, when we were talking to DJ Meyer earlier, the winner of the Poetry Out Loud competition for Iowa this year, he was mentioning that when he's in Washington, D.C., which he is right now, he was hoping to visit Gallaudet University, and that is a university for the deaf. Do a lot of students from the Iowa School for the Deaf go on to Gallaudet?
Yes, we certainly have a number of students each year that will go in that direction. Well, graduating classes can vary. You know, this is a big year in terms of the graduating class size, and it's at 21. And so when I see a number of students, you have to keep that in perspective to how big the graduating class is. But there will be a few students from this graduating class that are headed for Gallaudet this fall and are really looking forward to it. And we have faculty and staff that are graduates of Gallaudet University and then have come back to Iowa and are either teaching or working in other support roles with us here in Iowa.
When you became superintendent of the Iowa School for the Deaf, you were already superintendent of the Iowa Braille and Sight Saving School, and then you took on this added responsibility, and that was about a year ago. There was, in spite of your excellent performance in Vinton, there was a little bit of pushback when you were appointed because you are not fluent in American Sign Language. Has it been a challenge to try to understand deaf culture and speak with a lot of people who obviously have a very important stake in this school since you're not fluent in ASL?
Yeah, I'd say it's been an opportunity and a good one. And I certainly at the time had some level of understanding of why that would be a concern and have even greater level of understanding as we've moved forward during this last year in terms of direct communication and the importance of that. But generally speaking, what I have found is the ability to communicate really pretty effectively with the deaf community at large and certainly with our student body, especially for those when I want to convey a message that's more than just a social greeting kind of message, I do have to rely more heavily on an interpreter in order to make sure that the message is being conveyed. But, you know, I've picked up some level of sign language during this last year and can do at least basic communication. I know that our student body and the deaf community in large appreciate my efforts towards direct communication with them. And so even though there would be some advantages of having everybody that can communicate at high levels directly, I think we've made it work in a pretty good way during this last year.
Well, so many of us communicate now in text-based formats with email and text messages. I would guess that would be a a tremendous advantage in trying to integrate into this world.
It is, but that's still secondary in terms of communication and that direct person-to-person approach, be it with students or members of the deaf community, is still expected and desirable and all of that. And sometimes you just pull out a pad of paper and a pen and go at it and accommodate it in that way. And, I have found nearly all people that are deaf, adults as well as our students, to be very patient in terms of my effort to communicate in a direct way with them and appreciative of doing so.
Now, I used the term deaf culture earlier, which is a concept that I think a lot of us who've never really had to deal with deafness or known of people in the deaf world may sound a little strange, but, this is an entire language that deaf people have that is apart from the English that we speak in this country. Can you help us understand a little bit of what deaf culture means?
Yeah. I think somebody that is a part of the deaf culture could do a much better job than I could in terms of describing all aspects of what it means to them. But again, for people that are, especially those that are deaf, but even deaf and hard of hearing, there is a degree of isolation that definitely comes along with that. And I guess I'd parallel it to people that speak another language other than English and do not speak English. They're often going to be more drawn together in support of each other in terms of that direct communication of each other and all of that. And I think that that's largely what has happened within the deaf community is that comfort level of being able to be with people where that communication barrier is not a barrier. And then it certainly goes beyond that in terms of the history and in our society, hopefully most of which is past, but our history in our society of lack of full inclusion of people with disabilities into the greater society. And, the last one, I think, advocacy, or that the deaf culture is about people who have a common need coming together to be strong advocates for themselves and where we need to go into the future in terms of what our society should look like about for all people and not having people speak for them, but being able to speak for themselves in terms of their own self-advocacy as a group.
I mentioned before that with the Iowa Braille and Sight Saving School, that has transitioned to being a day school and a support for education around the rest of the state. What do you see as the future for the school for the deaf? Is that an institution that will continue to have a boarding school in the future?
I believe it will, and I believe it will long into the future. I expressed some of the differences a little while ago, and I think for those reasons that is true, that it plays an important part on that continuum of services for students who are deaf and hard of hearing. One of the really good services is Iowa School for the Deaf, but between the area education agencies and the local school districts, you can go anywhere in Iowa and get services and get good services. What Iowa School for the Deaf does is provide a service on that continuum that's more intense, more frequent, has more intensity of instruction, more direct in terms of communication. So it will definitely serve that role well into the future. We're planning for the future in terms of what services for children that are deaf and blind should look like in Iowa. And we're planning for regional programs in the state of Iowa to enhance what already exists. Those services that I spoke to that are being provided by the local districts and area education agencies, as well as the services provided at Iowa School for the Deaf. Those are good services, but there seems to be some undermet needs. And so we're planning into the future in terms of how to meet those needs that are somewhere between what currently exists and what exists at Iowa School for the Deaf.
And let's turn now to the Iowa Braille and Sight Saving School.
Sure.
Can you describe for me the role of the Iowa Braille and Sight Saving School now that obviously there are students who still go there for an education as a day school, but what is the focus of your work now that it is not a boarding school?
Yeah, the name of the structure for the system right now is the Iowa Educational Services for blind and visually impaired. And what that agency does, that it's the same as the Iowa Braille School, but Iowa Braille School is more about the place in Vinton, and Iowa Educational Services is more about the statewide service, that organization. So what we do from the Vinton campus is provide services throughout the state to all the students that are blind and visually impaired, including those with additional disabilities. So the Iowa Educational Services for Blind and Visually Impaired serves 500 and some students statewide with teachers of the visually impaired, with orientational mobility specialists, with consultant types of staff. And so those services are provided on a daily basis. And then periodically, students will come to the Iowa Braille School campus for extended learning kinds of opportunities, for weekend event, week-long events, certainly summer events, so that they can benefit from instruction in the expanded core curriculum, those areas of instruction that they need because of being blind, that they are not learning incidentally from observing others. That happens through these more extended learning opportunities that happen on the Iowa Braille School campus.
And Braille obviously would be a specialized skill that people who are visually impaired might need and would not be learning in their regular schools necessarily. What are some of those other skills that these students would be coming to the campus to learn?
Some of the other areas of need, again, because students who are blind have less ability, sometimes no ability to observe what's happening around them. Often, recreational kinds of skills, socialization types of skills, the use of technology, and there's some high-end technology for students that are blind that definitely needs direct instruction in order to learn. The mobility skills, how to get from one place to another as a young child, how to crawl from here to there as a college student, how to maneuver a campus, all of that. Those are some examples of those extra skills that need to be taught beyond the core curriculum of the district.
You mentioned trying to create regional services. Right now, do the teachers that you have who are interacting with blind students at their schools, do they have to do a lot of traveling?
They do, and that certainly is one of the necessities of a rural district, and one of the disadvantages is that a lot of their time is windshield time, and that detracts from the amount of time that they're with students in doing direct instruction. Now, one of the advantages of coming together as a statewide system is that we've reduced some of that windshield time by how we assign people statewide, but it's still a great, it's still significant. And so by bringing together regional programs, those kinds of services that I just described would continue, but there would also then be a classroom-based model for some students that need more intensity, such as somebody that's learning Braille, that they would be able to come to this classroom-based model for a year or two or 3 years, or what's required while they're really learning Braille so that they can apply that learning to their other learning. That's the idea behind the regional programs is to provide more intense instruction for some of the students that need it, not to replace what already exists, but add to what already exists.
You have overseen a lot of changes with this program. What do you see as your greatest challenges in the future as you've gone through these transitions and tried to meet all these needs?
I think we're on the road to that. Certainly the development of the regional programs and having that plan in place and then the implementation of that plan, which will be incremental, will start in some locales and then build upon it from there. From what we learned from the initial learning is one of the greatest challenges that I get the opportunity to help lead. I think it's really important. I think that Iowa is doing very good in terms of our services, but there are some gaps there. And so this is our opportunity to really look at what needs to be different in the future and to work with partners in terms of making that happen. So, you know, the challenge of bringing everybody together for this purpose, certainly the fiscal challenges are always great, and as we look to designing a program that adds to what we currently exist. We're trying to be careful about fiscal resources, but it may very well cost more to do more than where we're at now. And so we'll need the support of others, including legislative type of request, in order to move that forward.
Can you give me a specific example of some of the gaps that you're hoping to fill?
I think the one that I gave you in regard to Braille instruction and intensity of instruction would be a specific example of a gap that is there. I think for students that are deaf and hard of hearing, that some of them are so isolated in terms of they're the only student who is deaf and hard of hearing in that school district or that school building, that for some of them to bring a group of students who are deaf and hard of hearing together with staff people that are able to communicate both orally as well as in manual communication will be an advantage for some students in terms of that direct communication piece. And through this interview, I talked a little bit about those extra areas of learning that are important, that expanded core curriculum for students that are deaf, and a different expanded core curriculum for students that are blind because their needs are different. Those are areas of focus that could be delivered through a regional program type of model that is really difficult for a local school district or an AEA alone to be able to manage and deliver. You know, students that are blind, and to some degree students that are deaf, but students that are blind, independent living skills. You know, that, again, a lot of young people learn that through observation. And with students that are blind, it's learned through good instruction.
There has been a societal shift in recent years when we talk about special education because of an increasing awareness of autism and those students who are on the autism spectrum.
Sure.
And also, of course, there has been an increasing number of these students as well, not just awareness. Has the focus in the media and in societal conversations on that kind of special education, do you feel that that has obscured some of the need that you've been dealing with?
I certainly do not see any kind of competition with other areas of disability, such as autism. You know, the needs are great there, and the prevalence has certainly increased. You know, and the disabilities don't discriminate, and so there's this kids that are autistic who have sensory impairments of being blind and being deaf, that being deafblind in terms of both of those. And you know, there's also good things that come out of this. I think with not necessarily the higher prevalence, but all of the attention that has been brought to the needs, is that there is more public awareness of the needs of individuals who are disabled, regardless of what that disability is. Hopefully, we're getting to a place where there's more awareness of the abilities of people with disabilities as well as those struggles that they have in their life. So, you know, maybe at some point that regional program model that I spoke of would have some benefits for other low-incidence kinds of populations. But right now, we're focusing on those that are deaf and blind in the design of that structure.
Patrick, thank you so much for your time today.
Really, I appreciate doing it, and thanks for having me.
Patrick Clancy is the superintendent of both the Iowa School for the Deaf and the Iowa Braille and Sight Saving School. Talk of Iowa is produced by Emily Woodbury, Dennis Reese, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, our home improvement expert Bill McAnally will be here. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.